Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Thanks for listening and being part of my podcast. I hope 2024 is kind to you. In my 27 years as a Victorian policewoman, I investigated everything from a stolen bicycle to a stolen life. Policing taught me a lot about human nature, which I explore in my podcasts with a mixture of interesting and thought-provoking guests discussing the human side and impact of crime on all those involved, including the investigators. And I'd love for you to give me a review if you can. They're just a great help to me. I give my guests the opportunity to tell their story in their own words and how they remember an incident. It may not be how others remember it, which I ask you to please keep in mind. My podcasts are not suitable for children and some adults for that matter. If you find yourself affected by my subject matter, contact Lifeline or any other support service or person you feel comfortable with. Thank you.
But he shoved it straight into my arm. And I'm thinking to myself, well, if I don't die of the injuries that I've received during the bus, I'm going to die of injuries received.
That's what I'm thinking.
But how I managed to survive that is beyond me.
Last week, I had the pleasure of introducing you to Peter Eames, who was a policeman here in Victoria for around 33 years. In 1999, Peter was involved in a 19-hour siege in Kangaroo Flat, a suburb of Bendigo, where four police were shot. Thankfully, all of them survived, and Peter was one of those policemen. There were many heroic efforts on this day which have resulted in a number of bravery awards, not only for police but also members of the public who put their own lives at risk to assist police who'd been shot and lay injured, unable to move. Peter was a senior constable at Bendigo and was one of the first to arrive at the scene and was attempting to converse with the gunman when he was shot first in the chest and then in his upper leg. Miraculously, Peter survived, as did the other three police who were subsequently shot. This siege remains the single largest number of police shot in the one incident in Victoria's history. But on talking to Peter, the siege pales into insignificance, would you believe, compared with the trauma and grief that he endured in Egypt on the 12th of January 2006. Today we go in depth about what happened on that day in Egypt. And to those listening who have lost loved ones on that trip, I apologise in a way for bringing up such a painful period in your life. But those who died, they deserve to be remembered fondly and not forgotten. Peter was part of a 90-strong contingent of Australians made up of police and emergency workers and their friends and relatives who were on a professional and cultural exchange with Egyptian police organised through the Egyptian Federation of Victoria and organised twice a year since 1990, and I believe it's still going. Peter was on a bus which overturned on a desert road around 45k from Cairo, where six people died. Two of those being Peter's brother-in-law, Mark, and his nephew, Drew. Many more were injured. Peter had invited Mark and Drew along to what was going to be the trip of a lifetime, as they were all fascinated with all things Egypt. Peter miraculously survived, yes, yet again, with broken bones, cuts and bruises, but a broken heart. Today, Peter takes us through the events of that tragic day, recalling everyone being tired after a long day and the majority falling asleep on the bus trip home. Peter's one of the few still awake when he recalls seeing the bus driver's head drop, obviously nodding off to sleep. To this day, Peter has pangs of guilt, which he's had to try and manage because, as Peter says, if he hadn't invited them along, they would more than likely still be with us today. But Peter is realistic enough to understand that nothing could have forewarned them of what would happen on that bus trip. It's hard to imagine how there could be some lighter moments in Peter's grief, but he has such a kind and caring manner and he's able to find some moments of pure gold that he shares with us, particularly the story of the Egyptian smoking doctor wheeling in a filthy, bloody IV drip, Peter waking up in hospital to a cat licking his face. Yes, I'm still having nightmares about that. And his first class trip back to Australia. Have a great week and enjoy my last part of my interview with Peter. Thank you. So did you feel like you'd had a second chance at life? Like, is that how it affected you or?
Yeah, I did have a second chance at life. It probably wasn't my turn. I think we've all, my opinion is we've all got a certain time limit and that wasn't mine. And that particular occasion.
And so physically, you've recovered. What about emotionally?
Yeah, look, emotionally, most definitely. I had my down times early on, not long after it. It was a bit of a difficult period. But at the end of the day, if I suppose as a police officer, if you're shot on duty, which is very, very few police in their career, very, very few, a tiny, minuscule amount have been shot in their career. And I'm one of those.
And I was going to say, and, you know, they call you lucky for short. Yes.
Yeah, that's right. I am very lucky in that respect, but it wasn't my time, I didn't think.
Gee, you had a good go, though.
Oh, yeah,
didn't he?
I did.
Twice?
He did.
Trying to kill you?
My understanding is that he was a very, very good shot. His friend said in the inquest.
Well, in the middle of the chest.
In the middle of the chest. Apparently it was a very good shot. And that particular evening he'd made a homemade silencer and put it over the barrel, obviously so we couldn't see exactly where he was shooting from.
Gee, so, he had a, as you said, he had a mission, didn't he?
There's no doubt. Mm. His mission was to kill as many police officers as he could.
But he killed his father as well.
Yeah, his father and he killed himself, as you said earlier in the introduction. Mm. So, look, to be honest with you, insofar as horrible injuries or critical incidents where police have been injured, when I look at this overall incident, I think to myself, well, okay, we're alive and he isn't. Yeah. And to me, that's the way I can sort of can deal with this, to know that that man is, not here anymore.
Yeah.
And so I personally think that if he went to jail, if he didn't kill himself, if he went to jail, he probably would have been out in 12 years or something like that.
Mm.
And I probably would have seen him because I would have been still on the job.
Mm.
So that would have been more traumatic for me. So the result was fitting in my belief.
How did your kids and your wife at the time, how did they manage?
Well, when I was at work that particular evening, two senior policemen knocked on the door at home. And as soon as she opened up the door, she broke down and cried because she knew something would have happened to me.
Yeah.
Because she knew it was obviously at work.
Yeah.
And, she was apparently fairly uncontrolled at that stage. Mm. But when I was lying before I went into surgery, she'd come in and I could see her out of the corner of my eye and she said, "Hang on." And I said, "I will. Don't worry." And she said to me later on, "I could see blood coming out of your mouth. You look really, really ill," and all the rest of it. And I said, "Yes, I know, but I'm too stubborn to go yet. I'm not going yet."
That's what I thought. Thank God you're stubborn.
Exactly.
And what about your kids? How did they, did they ever want you to leave policing after that or?
Yeah, my second eldest daughter, Lara.
How old was she at the time?
Let me see. She was I think she was about six at the time, from memory. Probably about 6 years of age at the time.
Yep.
And she asked me, am I going to still be a policeman?
Oh, gee, I bet she did.
Yeah. And I said to her, yes, I will be. I mean, I didn't tell her the main reasons why, but, you know, I said, yes, I will be a policeman, but I'll just have a – I'll be staying off work for a little while. So I think in total I took about 12 months off work, which in hindsight was a good amount of time to take off.
Why did you stay?
Well, to be honest with you, it's not the love of the job. It wasn't the love of the job at all. It was because I had a young family, I had a mortgage, and I had financial responsibilities. So I had to, at that stage, bypass any kind of emotions that I had towards returning to the job and just do what I had to do and be a breadwinner for my family. That was basically it.
But you would have been, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing, I know, but you would have been well looked after by the police, you would hope, wouldn't you? Like, yeah, you'd hope so, but you never know. Anyway, you went back and for because you had responsibilities.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. That's correct. Otherwise, if there was another job going around with similar money at the time, I would have gleefully jumped at it. But here I was.
Sorry.
Here I was, 39 years of age, 40, and, you know, I'm entered middle age and the only thing I know is police. I was hoping that they would have given me a non-operational position because of the rarity of the incident.
Of course. And when you say you were hoping, did you actually have to apply for that non-operational position that you took?
Well, the position I took was there happened to be a Bendigo D24 at the time.
Okay.
So that's about the best they could do for me because there was nothing else.
I would have thought they would have said, where do you want to go? What do you want to do? You know, because of what you had been through. But
well, interestingly enough, there was an assistant commissioner, I think he was, who basically was asked that very question, how about giving this policeman a non-operational position?
Yeah.
And he replied similar to, well, if I do that for him, I'll have to do that for everyone.
Oh, yeah, for everyone that's shot.
Yes, that's exactly his opinion. And I thought to myself, wow, that's what they really think of us.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, in my view, command is only looking after itself. And if anything happens like a shooting, well, that could be a reflection on the commissioner who's in charge of training at the time. That's the way I see it.
And you know what? You're probably not far wrong. Oh, boy. You said in one of the conversations we had in prep for today, you said that you should have left. Oh, no, you've just answered that. I was going to say that you should have left after the siege, but you didn't. But the reason you didn't was because financially you wanted to be secure. Okay. Did you feel that the siege changed you? And if so, in what ways?
Well, I guess, that was the start of my PTSD. Of course, so that's...
Gee, I wonder why.
Yeah, that's what changed things.
Yeah.
But I suppose really it's how, again, the resilience of a person, how to deal with it. And I thought the first thing I need to do is get better physically. And that was my main objective at that stage, get better. So I had a lot of light exercises to do and I had a nurse visit me regularly. And so I had a set routine for the physical side of things. And so far as the psychological side of things, I had a guy that a psychologist that I went and saw every couple of weeks.
Through the police? Please tell me yes.
Yes.
Yes, good.
Well, I was on that mental health program where you get a number of free visits. So, yes, I kept that going for quite some time. And that was helpful. But there's only certain things I need to discuss to understand with myself. As I said, the main thing is get the body right, then get the head right, and then you can move on from there. If you've got to have both those things right, especially the head.
Yeah.
And being resilient is something I'm proud of, actually.
You should be.
Because otherwise, I think there'd be some people in the world that probably would be sort of all bunched up in a corner and sucking their thumb, I suppose, if they'd had these two incidents happen to them.
And, you know, I think in a way, well, not I think you'd be very justified
Indeed. In
feeling like that. And I think not everybody has the, well, I don't know, the strength or the support, whatever it be, to keep going. You know, like there's a lot of people that, well, that couldn't keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So you returned to policing in a less dangerous role, however, but just as important. And then 2006 comes along. So what's this? This is 10. Well, how long after the shooting? Hang on. What's that?
6 or 7 years.
All right. Okay. So 6 or 7 years later, you're with your brother-in-law and your nephew, Drew, and you decide to go on the trip to Egypt. Again, would you mind, in as much or less detail as you feel comfortable, can you tell us about that trip?
Yes. I'd had an interest in Egypt for a long time. I was just fascinated with Egypt, like many people.
Yes.
You see the Sphinx or the pyramids.
Oh, the pyramids. How did they ever make them? I still don't understand.
Yes. Yeah. And that was.
Build them. Yep.
Yes. That was the highlight of the trip.
Yeah.
And my brother-in-law and my nephew were also very interested in Egypt too. And I knew that because we'd had a lot of discussions beforehand.
Mm.
And it was sort of like a last minute thing. I asked Mark, would you like to come? Would you like to come to Egypt with me? And he looked at me very
seriously. How old was he at this point?
Well, I was 2006, so.
Would he have been an adult?
Oh, well, my brother-in-law was a couple of years older than me.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
And my nephew at the time was 13.
Okay, righto.
And so when I said, why don't you come along?
Oh.
You know, we could have, you know, it'd be great because I'm going by myself. I don't know anyone that's on the trip. So.
Yeah.
He said, yeah, I'd love to. And so there it was. Here we were going to Egypt. You know, it was. And it was a long, long way to get there with a stopover at Kuala Lumpur, I remember, and then to Cairo. We arrived at Cairo at 2 o'clock or 1 o'clock in the morning, I think it was.
Yeah.
And I walked out onto the landing and saw it was a very, the amount of activity that was – there was at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, in Cairo. It was just amazing. There was people and cars everywhere.
Yeah.
There was smog I remember seeing.
Yeah.
And it was just totally different. But I was here.
Yeah.
You know, I've you know, if anything I do for the remainder of my life, at least I've been to Egypt and I've seen this.
Yes, yeah.
And so, of course, we all got settled in and everything like that. And and then, you know, we had a schedule or two of what we were to do during the 2 weeks we were going to be there.
Yeah.
And all that was looking fantastic. And we did a few things there. Like the main thing was visit the Sphinx and the Pyramids of Giza. And we did we went to the police academy or their police academy and their dog squad academy and all their fire brigade academy. And so we had quite a bit of experience. That was really, really interesting, I found.
Yeah.
And it's something they obviously do for a lot of people because they've got this set routine of doing things.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were quite fascinated and we had lunch, I remember. In the main cafeteria area, it was a really fascinating. Like it's their academy is just gargantuan. It really is. You can't see the border fences or anything like that. Mm. It was called the Mubarak Police Academy at the time. So that was all that kind of stuff was fantastic. And this particular day in question, we were going up to the north, up to Al Alamein, to visit some war graves of past Australians at Fort. For us during the Second and First World War. And we went up there and then that was an all-day kind of thing. And then we went into a cafe and with those, I can never ever say what they are, you know, those hookers, those we went into this hooker, when I say that, where they suck through the pipes.
Oh, they look like they're smoking marijuana.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And then we decided to have a
go. I didn't know what you meant by hookers.
Yes, I had to become, sorry, I knew this was going, because I've been trying to pull back on that. So that's what we did, and it was an apple cinnamon one, I remember, and you put it in and we were all have smoking. We were having a great time, so I'm not sure whether there was anything more than what people reported to say, but it was a really good day. It was a good night.
Yep.
And everyone was tired. because it had been a long, long day. We started very early that morning. And so we all jumped on the bus. And as we were travelling along, I could see, I was wide awake, I could see people falling asleep behind me. And my brother-in-law, he went across onto the other chair on the other side of the aisle, and he was sort of sleeping by himself on two chairs. And my nephew was in front of him doing the same thing. And I was awake, and I was just looking around, and I think 95% of the people were asleep. But I was awake. And then all of a sudden, I noticed that the bus driver's head had dropped a little bit. And I was thinking he must be looking at his watch or looking at something else. And then we all of a sudden we started to veer to the right. And then it was obviously this man had fallen asleep temporarily. And then he realised that he was going off the road, so he quickly tried to go back onto the road.
Correct himself.
Absolutely. And he did that. He did the quick steering wheel turn to the left. And as a result of that, the bus just went over. And as it flipped over in the air, I was thrown through a window that was right next to me, because I was sitting next to the window. I was thrown through. And all I remember, it happened so quickly, that I was travelling or sailing through the air, and I hit the sand, and I landed on my bum, which is probably the softest part, I suppose. And then I just sat there, and then I was a bit dazed at that stage, and I noticed the bus, it feels like it was on its roof, and I remember seeing and hearing the wheels turning as it was there. It was probably for about, I don't know, 10 metres from me where I was sitting, and then I immediately sat up to try to get up and see people needed help. And then when I tried to stand up, I was in absolute agony, pain. I sat down a bit and I think, I've broken something pretty bad, because, you know, I was in a lot of pain at that stage. So I just sat up and I was looking around me, and I think, as I mentioned to you on the phone, it was like what you see on television, you know, if there's a bomb gone off in the Middle East and there's people running around in pain, crying, there's fires going, and there's people lying on the ground dead or dying and so forth. And that's exactly what it looked like when I was looking around and watching this unfold in front of me, thinking, I don't believe this. This isn't happening, surely. But it was. And at the time I had a roommate who was a Chinese-Canadian. His name was Herman. And he came up to me and said, Peter, are you okay? And I said, yep. Can you do one thing for me? Please look for my brother-in-law, Mark. He knew it.
Yeah.
And so I said, could you do that now for me? And so off he went, and he came back about 3 or 4 minutes later, and he said, I'm sorry, Peter, he's dead. He's lying on the ground, he's dead. I said, okay, no worries. Can you see if you can find Drew? And he went off, and he was gone for about 5 or 10 minutes or something like that. And he came back and he said,
ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Said, no, I can't find him anywhere. And my thoughts were at that stage that he's trapped under the bus and most definitely deceased. Mm. And I thought to myself, why is this happening to me? What did I do to deserve this? And I thought, you know, what turned out to be the trip of a lifetime has been an utter damn tragedy of epic proportions. And that's exactly what it was. Then all of a sudden a couple of ambulances arrived, which were like transit vans. They looked like transit vans, and they were doing some triaging. And, of course, I wasn't the most injured person there, but so they took the most injured people away first, clearly, and off they went. And then they picked me up on this very, very ancient stretcher, and then they shoved me in the back of a...
Sorry, I don't mean to laugh.
No, that's okay.
I can almost see it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they just shoved me into this transit van, which was supposed to be an ambulance, but there was nothing inside to indicate it was an ambulance. It was just a floor and whatever else.
Almost archaic.
I'd say well and truly archaic.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there I was lying there, and I was surprised that they weren't going. And I'm thinking, oh, of course, there's some space next to me. And then the doors flew open again, and all of a sudden they pushed a woman in, a middle-aged woman, and I think she was dead because I was looking at her face and I said, are you okay? And I didn't get a response, and I could see blood on her face and everything like that. So she was dead. Then we went off they were screaming into the microphone in Arabic and the sirens were going, everything like that.
Chaos.
Absolute chaos, absolute chaos. And then we landed at the Cairo General Hospital. And that was fairly chaotic in there too, because not only were all these injured people from the bus there was also other people.
Of course,
as well. And they allow all their relatives and friends of relatives and everyone else to come into the ward as well. So I was being bumped around, pushed around by people though who couldn't care less. I was there and I was in a world of pain once again.
Yeah.
And it turned out that I had 7 or 8 broken ribs, a broken collarbone, and I had about a 10 or 15 centimetre gash in my left calf muscle. So needless to say, I was in a bit of pain. And eventually I recall they did a quick examination. They could see that there was no internal injuries. It was just merely broken bones. Apart from the bullet.
Bloody hell.
I'm thinking over there, they were probably bypassed. I don't know.
But, excuse me, sir, but we've found a bullet here. Bloody hell. Go on.
And so from there on, I was taken into another area, another room, and I'm not sure if I might have mentioned this in our last conversation, but I was just laying there and all of a sudden the door opened and a middle-aged man walked in with a smoke hanging out of his mouth.
In the hospital?
In the hospital, yeah. And he was wearing a white coat, like the traditional old white doctor's coat, but this one was caked with blood and some other things that were indescribable. So it was filthy. And he was wheeling in an IV drip. And as he was wheeling it past me, I could look down at the tripod part of it, and it was caked with blood and other things. It hadn't been cleaned since it was given to the hospital. And then, of course, he felt very rough, and he shoved it straight into my arm. And I'm thinking to myself, well, if I don't die of the injuries that I've received during the bus, I'm going to die of injuries received.
That's what I was thinking.
How I managed to survive that is beyond me. But, so he did all that kind of stuff. And then they took me upstairs to one of the wards. They put me in this bed I was in a world of pain. I didn't have any injections for pain. There was nothing.
No English.
No English, just the odd smile and whatever else. And then they laid me down and put about 15 blankets on top of me. And I was completely immobile. I could not do anything. I was just looking around thinking, what the hell is going to happen now? But just to add a little bit more to this story of
like it needs more,
I always find some amusing things in critical incidents. Anything that happens, I always find a little bit of humour in it.
Yeah.
And I'm lying there for a couple of minutes and all of a sudden the silence was broken by the sound of a cat meowing. And that cat, what have they got? Oh, it's Egypt, that's right. They've got like an affinity with cats, you know, from their history. So I thought, okay, it stands to reason they've got a cat in here, that's okay. And it meowed again, but it was sounded like it was getting closer and closer and closer. And all of a sudden, bang, it jumped straight up on my chest.
Oh, my God.
And it was looking me straight in the eye, this big red and white cat.
Oh, that would kill me. I would die of a heart attack.
And it just jumped up and thought, oh, this is great. And it started headbutting me or smooching me or headbutting me. And, and I'm not a great cat lover, but this thing was headbutting me all around the place. And I'm saying, get away. And I was swearing at it, get away from me. And this cat was loving it. It was just getting so many headbutts and smooches in because this guy couldn't do anything. He was just completely immobile.
Oh, my God.
So that was the humorous part about it I found.
Oh, I don't find that funny at all. I'd find that horrendous. However, you do have another story about another man, a dignitary.
Oh, yes. Well, when I was in
Boy.
Yes, I forgot about that.
How could you forget about it? I still think about it. I have nightmares about it.
Well, so when I was this is before they took me upstairs to the ward, when I was still down in the ER section, I was approached by, a middle-aged gentleman in a suit, and he said to me that he was at the embassy, the Australian embassy, whether he was the what position he held, but I think he was just a dignitary or perhaps someone there high up. And he had a camera with him, I noticed. And he said to me, "You're a policeman, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "I've got a number of pictures here of deceased people, and I'd like you to, if you can, try to identify them for us." And I said, worries. I'll do that. So he started going through the photographs, and I understand.
Yes.
I understand why this needs to be done.
I do too. Horrendous, but then he does need to identify these people ASAP.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I understand. Yep.
So we went through all those people, and we went through about two or three, and Mark wasn't there.
I was going to say, please tell me your brother-in-law or
but they
Drew.
Did. No, he was Drew wasn't there. But Mark was, his picture was, as I said, he didn't look as though he had any injuries at all. But one of the guys there who's a sergeant at the traffic alcohol section he was, and we got on reasonably well. He was in the picture as well. He passed away, and his wife, I think she lost her foot or a couple of toes on her feet.
God, yes.
So there was a series of deceased people he showed me. And I obviously did that because it was a policeman.
Yeah,
I'm used to seeing people dying. And I guess because this is going to be a hugely newsworthy incident in Australia, and it certainly was, as we know.
Yes.
So they really need all the information as quick as they can. So I gave them as much as I could to help them before they took me up to the ward. So, to be honest with you, at the time, I thought it was a bit in your face. But,
yes.
But, I just understood, when I looked at the whole incident, the whole thing, I thought, okay, he needs to do this stuff. This is his job. And, I mean, it's not as if I haven't seen deceased people before. So,
but seeing deceased people, and look, I'm not, it's easy to criticise, and I get that, because I feel like what a terrible thing to do to somebody who has clearly been in an accident, traumatized, whatever. However, you're right. He has a job to do. He needs to identify these people. And how can he when, like, this is in Egypt, you would know the people. It would take them days, sometimes weeks to identify them. But the fact that your own brother-in-law was in those photos, I just can't imagine.
It was awkward. It was difficult. The whole thing happened so quickly and so soon that I didn't have a chance to emotionally, it wasn't until I got back to Australia. And I was able to sit in my lounge room and just, and that's when I spoke with my family, and that's, I got a little bit emotional about everything that happened.
Yeah.
The thing is, and I still feel this today, and I feel partly responsible because I allowed I could have easily not said anything to my brother-in-law and not told him about the trip, and he'd be still with us today. We'd all be together. So even though I know that that scenario is ridiculous and it was his decision and all the rest of it, but nonetheless, there's something niggling away at me about that.
Yes.
That I feel responsible.
I imagine in a way that rightly or wrongly that you would have pangs of guilt.
Yes. Indeed. Absolutely.
Yeah, because I'm sorry, but it's true, isn't it,
yes.
that if you wouldn't have said, let's go, they wouldn't have.
That's right.
But but then again, it was the something that they had wanted all their lives, and particularly young Drew, and we haven't actually said, but Drew did pass away.
He did. His picture wasn't on that camera, and I did ask the ambassador or the dignitary, where's my picture of my nephew Drew? And he said, they did remove the remains of a young blonde adolescent male. So when they said that, it made me believe that his condition was so, traumatic or traumatizing that it's probably not good to see. So,
I believe that there was a couple of police that left Australia immediately. They heard about this bus crash and they went over there. Did you get to meet them at all? Or I suppose I'm asking about the support you received.
I think I met these two guys once, but I really didn't have too much to do with them, quite frankly. I think they were more interested in the bus accident itself.
Oh, okay.
And what actually happened, because they were going to be preparing an inquest brief for the coroner over here. So that was the crux of the reason they were there. Who I found to be the biggest winners or the biggest people that I respect mostly is the medical evacuation team that come over from Australia. There was at least one doctor and a couple of nurses.
Okay.
They just came over very, very quickly. And that was great for me because I was still in a lot of pain and there wasn't much pain medication available other than the odd tablet or something like that. So he had his actual briefcase.
Thank God.
Full of medication.
And I remember, give me some.
Yes, that's the first thing I said to him, can I have some strong pain because I'm in a world of pain here, all these broken bones. And so he gave that to me and that really was very helpful. And, look, when we were evacuated from the country, we went via England or Heathrow Airport, and he was sitting behind me. They gave us a first class on the way back.
So they should.
I think so.
I shouldn't say so they should, but that would have been appreciated, of course.
It was, very much so. We needed, I mean, there was a few of us on that trip that were in a world of pain, still suffering badly, and the doctor was sitting behind me at the time, and that was really, really good.
Reassuring.
It was reassuring because as we travelled along, he'd give me a tap on the shoulder and he'd say, Peter, how are you? On a pain scale 1 to 10, and I'd say about 8.
Gee.
And he'd say, no worries. And that'd be good for the next 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah. So your first class, but you wouldn't have known you were first. Well, for a moment you would have, but.
Yeah, but after that, who cared?
Yeah, you're right. I think I've said to you before, I'm aware that a very dear friend that I used to work with at Carlton, John Curnow, JC, his partner, the mother of their young boy, she passed away in the bus crash as well. Her name was Carol, but for some reason I've read that it was Christy.
Yes, Christy, I do.
Yeah, I do, but she was, I think you said she was behind you.
She was. She was sitting right at the back, probably about 1 or 2 seats behind me. A couple of the other girls.
I read something real. Well, look, there's a lot of sad stories, of course, but I remember John telling me that it was her first ever trip overseas. You know, there's just so many sad things. And, you know, she had a young Jack at home here and, you know, she was a lovely – anyway, look, it's just there's no rhyme nor reason, is there?
No, look, there's a lot of loss that was suffered.
Sorry, there is a reason. The bus driver, I'm sorry, but you've said it very clearly.
Yeah.
He was falling asleep. So there is a reason.
That's right, that's the reason. I guess, and I'll tell you something else too, what I was told, I didn't see it, but there was 2 buses in that particular tour. We were the front bus.
Yes.
So the rear bus actually saw what happened and they pulled up. alongside us. Now, my understanding was the bus driver, he was treated, I think he was beaten by the two security guards that, on either, or the security guard on either bus.
Right.
And they had the submachine guns. They were there to protect us. But after the accident, though, he was beaten very, very severely after that. That's what I was told by several people from that that other bus. As far as falling asleep, okay, I could.
Did you give evidence about that? I imagine you did, because
No, I didn't. I wasn't.
That's quite critical evidence, isn't it?
I didn't go to the inquest. I wasn't invited to go to the inquest,
even though you'd seen him nodding off.
Yeah, they weren't particularly
okay
interested, and I wasn't interested in going because I knew what happened. I wasn't going to learn anything.
No.
And
you weren't going to get back Drew and your brother-in-law.
Exactly right.
What was your brother-in-law's name?
Mark.
Mark, yeah. You weren't going to get them back, so yeah.
Exactly. I think it was pointless. I think
too painful.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't think there was any need for it. I mean, we'd all suffered great loss, all of us. You know. And,
do you know what happened to the bus driver?
I mean,
as in court-wise, was he ever – was?
I heard that he went to jail and then he was released – I don't know their legal system at all, but again, look, I guess in hindsight, I look at this and think, well, how many people, how many car accidents have we been to since the beginning of our career of accidents have happened because a driver has fallen asleep, fatalities, near fatalities.
Driver fatigue,
and I mean, that's certainly exactly right. So it's not foreign to us, and it's certainly not foreign to, you know, Egypt. And that stretch of road there, I mean, I was told that there was at least 1,000 people have died on that road every year.
Well, funny you mentioned – well, not funny, very strange you mentioned that, because I was telling my husband about I wanted to do a bit of research about the bus crash before speaking to you. And I looked up, I Googled Egypt bus crash because I wasn't sure of the year, and it was like – there were so many, like there were like every year. It was like it was just one after the other.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't really, from what I remember of the road, it wasn't that bad. You know, not as bad as some of the regional roads around here. You know? I mean, so I thought it was fairly good because it's a well patronised road. I mean, because it goes right to the north of the country. So,
so. How is your health now?
Excellent.
You've got that cat that was on top of you. Like, you've got 9 lives. I don't know how many that cat's had, but you have got 9 lives. And you start to use a few up, Pete. So I'd suggest, why don't you just go somewhere nice and quiet and just sit and relax?
Probably a good idea. It's interesting, after starting it, the traffic company, and I was the guy that I used to work with for so long.
Yeah.
He had a bit of a, I remember one day he had a bit of a chuckle to himself, and I looked across and I said, what's the problem? What's going on? And he said, I just thought to myself, you've been shot, you've been in a bus crash. Now things normally come in threes. So, and here I am working with you. So I'm getting a little bit worried just quietly. And with that, I just burst out laughing. I thought, what a funny thing to say.
Well, he's sort of right in a way.
Well,
I'm starting to feel a bit nervous myself.
You should be pretty
right. Just get out of here,
you? Should be pretty right for the time being. Look, to be honest with you, it's the health, the physical side's good. I go to the gym regularly because at the moment I'm not working, but that'll change.
Yeah.
But I just – look, it's important. Physical health is extremely important, especially as we enter our 60s.
Yeah.
We've got to look after ourselves because what's the old saying? If you don't use it, you'll lose it.
Yeah.
That's exactly what will happen.
Yeah.
And the mental health, look, generally speaking, very good.
Mm.
I mean, we all have our little dark times, though, where we fall into that little abyss.
Yeah, yeah.
But as my father told my sister, after Egypt, you're quite welcome to visit it, but don't stay there. And that's what he said to me. And I thought, well, and I thought, I never forgot those words. And I thought, well, that's exactly me.
Yeah.
But that's nothing unusual to anyone else.
Yeah.
You know, who might have had a lot less happen to them during their lives. But
look,
resilience is the key, and just keeping focused on what's important.
Yeah.
And that's your health.
Yeah.
Your fitness and your family. All those kinds of things.
Because you're right. Because you could be riddled with guilt, couldn't you? Let's say with Mark and Drew, you could be, but there's no point. It's happened. Yes, you feel bad, but you know, there's. I think it's about concentrating on the positives, and there are so many positives. Like your attitude, it's fantastic, and I can't help but admire you because if anybody's got an excuse to say, "Pardon me, the world's fucked," you know, it's you.
Yeah.
Really, but good on you for just being the sort of person you are. The police have lost a very, very good person.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Darrell. Thank you.
In closing, I think you've earned some time, Peter, to sit down, smell the roses and enjoy a quieter life. I believe you're in a good place. You've been fortunate to meet a lovely woman and life's pretty damn good. You've committed much of your life to helping others in so many ways and keeping the community as safe as you possibly can. Well, it's now time for others to take on that role, as you have literally nearly died saving others and suffered more than many performing that role, both physically and emotionally. Thank you for your service, your support and commitment to us all in living in a safer community. And thanks to Diane for contacting me. Thank you. As you've probably noticed, we've moved to a new platform called Acast. I think that's the right expression, I've got no idea. And my previous reviews haven't transferred over. I need reviews. Could you do me a favour and put up a review? And thank you so much for your support and patronage. With your help, I can give you that little bit extra. Thanks.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.